German-Russian author Alina Bronsky recently discussed her new novel at the Goethe Institute in Washington, D.C. Bronsky's novel, Broken Glass, tells the story of a 17-year-old Russian immigrant named Sasha Nyman who is living in Germany. The novel captures Sasha's exploration of her own power as she struggles to find an identity in a foreign land. Bronsky was born in Yekaterinburg, Russia, and moved to Germany at 13. Her breakthrough debut novel, Scherbenpark, brought her critical acclaim and was nominated for Young Adult Literature by the German Youth Literature Project. And now, Alina Bronsky reads excerpts from her latest novel, Broken Glass. The discussion is hosted by author Lane Jennings.
You know, I was taught that when I read in English, I have such a strong, lovely Russian accent, which my friends miss in my German, so I want to just take the chance and read it. What did we say? I start in English and then I switch to German. Sometimes I think I'm the only one in our neighborhood with any worthwhile dreams. I have two, and there is no reason to be ashamed of either one. I want to kill Vadim, and I want to write a book about my mother. I already have a title, The Story of an Idiotic Red-Headed Woman Who Would Still Be Alive If Only She Had Listened to Her Smart Oldest Daughter. Or maybe that's more of a subtitle. But I have plenty of time to figure it out because I have not started writing yet. Most of the people who live around here don't have any dreams at all, I've asked. And the dreams of the ones who do have them are so pathetic that if I were in their shoes, I'd rather not have any. Anna's dream, for instance, is to marry rich. Her dream man would be a judge in his mid-30s and, fingers crossed, not too terribly ugly. Weiter in Deutsch. Anna ist 17, genau wie ich, und sie sagt, sie würde so einen sofort heiraten, wenn er käme. Dann könnte sie endlich aus dem Solitär aus und in das Penthouse des Richters einziehen. Keiner außer mir weiß, dass Anna manchmal mit der Straßenbahn in die Innenstadt fährt und 13 Runden um das Landgericht dreht, in der Erwartung, dass der Richter endlich rauskommt, sie entdeckt, ihr eine rote Rose schenkt, sie erst zum Eis und dann in seine Penthouse-Wohnung einlädt. Sie sagt, man muss für sein Glück kämpfen, sonst zieht es an einem vorbei. Peter der Große dagegen, das ist ein weiterer Nachbar, träumt von einer echten Blondine mit dunklen Augen. Er war vorher mit Anna zusammen, sie hat braune Augen, ist aber nicht echt, jedenfalls nicht als Blondine. Jetzt hat er eine andere aus seiner Klasse. Das ist für ihn aber unpraktischer, weil sie in der Innenstadt wohnt und nicht im Solitär. Er flucht seitdem, dass er sein halbes Leben in der Straßenbahn verbringt. Dort hält er nach weiteren Blondinen Ausschau. An mir war er noch nie interessiert, mein Haar ist zu dunkel. Ich heiße Sascha Nyman. Ich bin kein Kerl, auch wenn das hierzulande jeder denkt, der meinen Namen hört. Ich habe aufgehört zu zählen, wie oft ich das den Leuten schon erklärt habe. Sascha ist eine Kurzform von Alexander und von Alexandra. Ich bin Alexandra. Mein Rufname ist Sascha, so hat mich meine Mutter immer genannt und so will ich auch heißen. Wenn ich mit Alexandra angesprochen werde, reagiere ich nicht. Manchmal denke ich, dass ich nie wieder neue Menschen kennenlernen will, weil ich es satt habe, jedem das Gleiche von vorn zu erklären. Warum ich Sascha heiße und wie lange ich schon in Deutschland lebe und warum ich so gut Deutsch kann, ungefähr 11-mal besser als alle anderen Russlanddeutschen zusammen. Außer Deutsch kann ich auch Physik, Chemie, Englisch, Französisch und Latein. Wenn ich mal eine 2 kriege, kommt der Lehrer zu mir und entschuldigt sich. Meine Mutter hatte darüber gelacht und gesagt, dass ich ihr unheimlich bin. Ich war ihr schon immer unheimlich, weil ich logischer dachte als sie. Sie war zwar nicht dumm, aber viel zu gefühlvoll. Sie hat mindestens ein dickes Buch pro Woche gelesen, spielte Klavier und Gitarre und kannte 1 Million Lieder. Aber logisch denken, das konnte sie nie. Ebenso wenig wie erkennen, wann es Zeit ist, einen Mann vor die Tür zu setzen. Das sind alles Fähigkeiten, die ich offenbar von meinem Vater habe. Ich weiß von ihm nur, dass er mehrere Doktortitel hatte und einen miesen Charakter. Den hast du auch schon, hat meine Mutter gesagt. Und die Titel werden bestimmt nachkommen. Dankeschön.
I'll read that, the last section again in English. Anna is 17, the same as I am. And she says she'd get married immediately if a guy like that came along. That way she could finally move out of the Emerald into the judge's penthouse apartment. Nobody but me knows that Anna sometimes takes the tram downtown and wanders a dozen times around the courthouse in the hope that her judge will finally come out and discover her and give her a red rose and take her ice cream and then invite her back to his penthouse. She says, "You'll never get lucky if you don't fight for it. If you don't fight, the moment will just pass you by." Peter the Great, on the other hand, dreams of a natural blonde with dark eyes. He was with Anna before. She has brown eyes, but she's not natural, not natural blonde, anyway. Now he's with another girl, one from his class at school, but it's less convenient. She lives downtown rather than here in the Emerald. Since they got together, he complains he spends half his life on the tram. But while he's on it, he keeps his eyes peeled for other blondes. "He was never interested in me. My hair's too dark." "My name is Sasha Neumann. I'm not a guy, even though everyone in this country seems to think so when they hear my name. I've given up counting how often I've had to explain it to people. Sasha is a short form for Alexandra and Alexander. I'm an Alexandra, but my name is Sasha. That's what my mother always called me. That's what I want to be called. When people address me as Alexandra, I don't even react. Sometimes I think I don't want ever to meet any new people, because I'm sick of having to explain everything from scratch. Why my name is Sasha, how long I've lived in Germany, how come I speak German so well, 10 times better than any other Russian Germans put together. Besides German, I also know physics, chemistry, English, French, and Latin. If I ever get a B on an assignment, the teacher comes over to me and apologizes." My mother laughed about it, said she found me a little scary. I was always scary in her eyes, though, because I thought much more logically than she did. She wasn't stupid, but she was too sentimental. She read at least one thick novel per week, played piano and guitar, knew a million songs. Math, physics, chemistry, she was no good at them. Just as she was no good at recognizing when it was time to show a man the door. "These are all abilities I must have gotten from my father. All I know about him is that he had multiple doctorates and an unpleasant personality." "You've got that too," my mother used to say. "And the degrees will no doubt come at some point." An interesting start. I think because the heroine is a young Russian who speaks excellent German, and a young woman, and the author is a young woman who is Russian and speaks excellent German, there is a question that we'd all like to ask her, but I'm not going to ask that question, at least not right now. And instead, I'd rather start out by asking about the form of your book. Scherbenbach is your first major publication as a fiction writer, and I wanted to ask, have you written other fiction before this, short stories or novels or what?
Yes, I must admit I did. It's Scherbenbach is my first fictional publication in general, but it's not my first book. It's also not my first novel. I'm wrong. It's my first book, but it's not my first novel. I mean, maybe I have 100 beginnings and lots of short stories. Writing was always a part of my life. So I began writing when I was maybe about 6. Short stories and fairy tales, and I actually never stopped it.
When you sit down to write, do you imagine an audience?
So,
who is it? I mean, are you writing for people your own age, or older people, younger people?
The first place, I write for myself only. I write to entertain myself, and I write stories which I am interested in. Thinking about an audience starts a bit later, if I'm rereading the things I wrote down. And then this feeling comes about people who may be interested in the same kind of stories, which I like.
It struck me when I was reading your novel that unlike some writers today, and the one who comes immediately to mind as an American is Dan Brown, writer of thrillers, but his style is to write many very short chapters, but each one ends with a cliffhanger, so you've just got to read one more little chapter. And the book is broken up so much that it's very easy to do this, and it's a very saleable technique. You have done just the opposite. Your whole novel is one long story. There are no breaks. There are no chapter breaks. There's no way for the audience to easily put down your book. But in a sense, I think that's done on purpose. Am I right?
Not really. I must admit, I'm not an intellectual writer who sits down and then thinks a lot about how he or she or me is going to be writing down this story. I just do it the way I like it and the way I sort of see or hear this story. In case of Sasha's story, I really heard her voice and I just wrote it down. And then when it was finished, I started thinking about chapters, because chapters are rather good for a book, and you know always when to stop. And it wasn't possible for me to make any chapters, to split this book up, because it was sort of really one thing. Yes, it's just how it was. But in my second book, I will have chapters.
Chapters help the reader, but I don't know if they help the writer. The publisher, if we had a publisher here, they could tell you whether it helps sell the book, but I'm not 100% sure. The one question I did have, though, is why did you write it as a novel rather than a screenplay or a graphic novel? It seems to me the kids today are mostly reading graphic novels or watching movies.
I don't think so. Well, I'm a writer. I'm interested in writing texts. It was rather obvious for me. But also kids today are interested in books, and well, lots of them have to read my book in school now, because German schools sort of discovered the book for their German classes. It was rather frightening for me, but now I sort of got used to it. And I can't complain about young readers reading it. So I wouldn't agree with what you said, that you only watch movies.
This is true. When you get to be my age, you have certain expectations about younger people, and you're always complaining about them. Oh, these younger people are not doing what we used to do.
I'll start soon, too.
What I do think this leads into very nicely is the question that came to my mind. Your book has gotten such good critical reception, and so in this country, too. I read a review in Library Journal that said, here is the kind of book one expects to see on high school reading lists. And it sounds like your book is already on high school reading lists in Germany. Did this surprise you, or did you know when you had finished it that you had something pretty special here?
Well, I believed in this kind of story. And in this book, it wasn't a book those times, it was only a manuscript. And I liked it a lot. I really believed in it. And I think you have to do so if you want to have it published. That was a difference to my other manuscripts, which I did not send to any publishing house. It was just sort of exercise for myself. So I was not so much surprised that there were some people who liked it as well as me, but I was surprised that there were so many. And the school thing was also, as I already said, sort of a scary experience, because I recalled my own school time and what I thought about books I had to read at school, and then my book would be one of these books, sort of torture the students. But then I started to like it. It's really a huge audience, and I have lots of invitations in schools, more than I can accept. And every time it's really very nice. It's really great.
Do you see your heroine, Sasha, really has a very, very distinct voice? And I think it's a mixture of funny lines and insightful lines and absolutely cold truth. There's not much romance here. She sees the world right as it is. And do you feel that this is something that young people today, perhaps young girls in particular, have, or is it something you've set out for them as an example? You'd like them to be more like Sasha, or they like her already?
Well, I think obviously there are some girls who think and behave like her, also some not only girls, adult women. I wasn't thinking about a generation. She sort of came to me, and I could really see her, and I want to describe her personal story, not the story of somebody else. It's just her, and for me, she's not only a heroine of my novel, she's really very real for me. And it's just her voice, the way she thinks and talks. And the thing I'm still surprised about, we are talking about the book as a book for younger readers only. But it's the first, when it was published by a publishing house which doesn't publish books for younger readers or children's books, not at all. It was just a normal novel. And it was a nice thing to see that so many different people read it, and also really generations. And of course, a popular question is, who reads it? Is it really a book for younger readers, or is it for adults? And oh, it's sort of both.
Your heroine starts out by saying she has two dreams. One of them is to write a book. What are your dreams? You've done that one.
I think I wouldn't tell them really now. one of my dreams was to write books and to be a sort of full-time writer, which I am now. And also some other dreams of mine just came true. But I think it's better not to tell them.
Or to tell them a little at a time in your books. I asked earlier why you'd written this as a novel rather than a screenplay, and can you tell me at this point whether there are plans to make a film of the book? And if there were, would you be interested in trying to adapt what you've written in one form for another medium?
The rights are sold, rights for film production in Germany, and it will be a TV movie. But I'm not really involved in this process, and I think I don't want to be involved. I want to be surprised by it, because I'm just a writer and not a script writer, as you asked me. That's the only thing I really love to do, is to write books, to write text. No scripts, no plays. And there will be also two theater plays in Germany in June based on the novel. Hmm. Also a surprise for me.
Well. It certainly resonates, and I think because you have a character who speaks and her voice is carries you the entire way through the book, it is something that actors will get their teeth into, and that I think directors will get their teeth into as well. Which leads me to ask: you've written about a world of Russians in Germany that you obviously. No, not obviously. You have made it real to us, whether it exists or not. There are writers that have the ability to make worlds real that don't exist, and I think it's not fair of us to assume that it actually exists just because you've written it. But you've made me believe it. So my question is: are you still interested in that world? Do you want to tell more stories about those people and those kinds of people, or are you interested in finding new worlds to write about?
Yes and no. My second novel, which I recently finished. It's also set some sort of between these worlds. What I really like is writing about people who are sort of between cultures and who have to find out where they belong to and things like that. I don't think I write more of these ghetto stories, like this book can be seen by some readers. I'll tell lots of different stories, but maybe this one common thing between them will be this thing between the cultures, moving between the cultures.
I have to ask this. Do you know in your own mind what becomes of Sasha after the book's action ends? And are you interested in telling the rest of the world what you know?
It's a very good question. For me, I don't know if anybody of you read the novel. I also don't want to spoil it for the ones who didn't read it. For me, she sort of disappears with the end of the book. I can't see her anymore. But I was so often asked about her future, possible future or not, that I really started thinking about how it would be. And I can see something of her 20 years later, when she's a woman, and maybe she has a family and is married, things like that. But not what happens after the action of this book ends. Mm.
There's an American writer, John Updike, who wrote a novel when he was a fairly young man called Rabbit Run, about a young man in Pennsylvania. And I think it was 10 years before he followed it up with another novel, and then 10 years later, still another, taking chunks of the man's life right up to his final demise. And it's very interesting and very effective, and I think it was more effective because he didn't try immediately to just, you know, keep the story going. He came back to it when something else had happened that interested him as a writer, and I have the feeling that that's sort of what you're saying. You're not interested in what happened to her immediately. She's out of your picture right now, but when she comes back, it'll be on your terms and when you're ready to write about her. I think we'd probably like to hear some more from the novel, if you would care to read some. And I have lots more questions, and I'm sure the audience does too, but the way we have this arranged, after you have read, the audience gets to ask some questions, and I think that would be our next move.
Okay. So I read it in German?
Half of please. It, or how many? Yeah, you can read...
some passages.
All right, if you like that, sure.
Okay. Ich hasse Männer. Anna sagt, dass es auch gute Männer gibt. Nette, freundliche, die kochen und sauber machen und Geld verdienen und Kinder wollen und Geschenke machen und Urlaub buchen und saubere Kleidung tragen und nicht saufen und vielleicht sogar gut aussehen. Wo gibt es die, frage ich da. Auf dem Mond? Anna behauptet, dass es solche Männer gibt. Wenn nicht in unserer Stadt, dann vielleicht in Frankfurt. Aber sie selber kennt persönlich auch keinen, höchstens aus dem Fernsehen. Deswegen wiederhole ich gern das, was meine Mutter immer gesagt hat. Ich bin mir selber ein Mann. Wobei sie das zwar gesagt, sich aber nie daran gehalten hat. Seit ich weiß, dass ich Vadim umbringen werde, geht es mir schon viel besser. Ich habe es auch meinem kleinen Bruder Anton versprochen, der 9 Jahre alt ist. Ich glaube, seitdem geht es ihm auch besser. Als ich ihm davon erzählt habe, hat er die Augen aufgerissen und atemlos gefragt, und wie willst du das machen? Ich habe so getan, als hätte ich alles im Griff. Es gibt 1000 Möglichkeiten, habe ich gesagt. Ich kann ihn vergiften, erwürgen, erdrosseln, erstechen, vom Balkon werfen, mit einem Auto überfahren. Du hast doch gar kein Auto, sagte mein Bruder Anton, und natürlich hatte er recht. Ich komme im Moment auch nicht an den Vadim ran, sagte ich da. Du weißt doch, er sitzt im Gefängnis. Er bleibt doch noch viele Jahre drin. Dann dauert es noch so lange, fragte Anton. Schon, sagte ich, aber das ist auch gut so. Ich kann mich besser vorbereiten. Weißt du, es ist gar nicht so einfach, jemanden umzubringen, wenn man es noch nie gemacht hat. Beim nächsten Mal geht es bestimmt besser, sagte Anton fachmännisch. Ich will erst mal dieses eine Mal über die Bühne bringen, sagte ich. Es soll kein Hobby werden. Es hat mich erleichtert, dass Anton die Idee gut findet. Schließlich ist Vadim sein Vater. Aber der Kleine hasst ihn genauso wie ich, wenn nicht noch mehr. Seine Nerven waren bereits vorher im Eimer, weil er im Gegensatz zu mir schon immer Angst vor Vadim hatte. Danke.
So, in English. I hate men. Anna says good men do exist. Nice, friendly men who cook and help clean up and earn money and who want to have children and give gifts and plan vacations. Who wear clean clothes, don't drink, even look halfway decent. Where on earth are they, I ask. She says they're out there, if not in our town, then in Frankfurt, but she doesn't know any personally. Unless you count the people she's seen on TV. And that's why I always repeat the words my mother used to tell me. I don't need a man. Of course, though she always said that, she never stuck to it. Ever since I decided to kill Vadim, I've felt a lot better. I also promised Anton, my 9-year-old brother, that I'd do it. And I think he feels better now, too. When I told him, he opened his eyes wide and asked, breathless, how are you going to do it? I acted as if I had everything under control. There's 1,000 ways I could do it, I said. I could poison him, suffocate him, strangle him, stab him, push him off a balcony, run him over in a car. You don't have a car, said my brother Anton. And he was right. I can't get at him at the moment anyway, I said. You know he's still in prison. He'll be there for years. Is that how long it's going to take? Said Anton. Yeah, I said, but it's better that way. I'll have plenty of time to plan it out. It's not that easy to kill somebody when you've never done it before, you know. It'll be easier the second time around, says Anton, like an expert. I just want to pull it off this one time, I said. I don't want to make a hobby of it. I was relieved that Anton also thought it was a good idea. Vadim is his father, after all. But the little guy hates him just as much as I do, maybe even more. He had already been a basket case beforehand because, unlike me, he was always afraid of Vadim. When I was younger, I thought I wanted to be famous, just like everybody else on the planet. I didn't have anything against the idea of having a well-known mother, either, who smiled from the cover of every magazine and was the talk of the town. But when we did become known, I could have shot them all the photographers and cameramen and reporters with their microphones and little notepads, filming the entrance to our building and knocking on our neighbors' doors to ask how loud it had been that night, and who screamed, who cried, who ran, whether Vadim had really said, "There's blood in there, don't go in," and "It's over, get out of here." The next day, my mother was in all the papers. Her first name and the first initial of her last name, it's the journalistic tradition here, along with her age and a photo. Back in those days, she'd been a star. And then suddenly Maria arrived, cousin twice removed, with three overstuffed suitcases brought from Novosibirsk. A chance for the traumatized children to form a family again. Vadim's cousin, by the way. I had agreed to her coming after the experience in the family services own department. I had an allergic reaction to the idea of entering any kind of institutional facility. So, Maria it was. Maria is in her mid-30s and looks 50. She used to work in a factory cafeteria in Novosibirsk. Maria has calloused hands as big as shovels with nails painted red. She has short hair, dyed blonde and permed, thick legs with varicose veins, though you can't see them through the wool stockings she wears. She's got a dozen floral print dresses, an ass so wide you could land a helicopter on it, perfume so sickly sweet it makes you sneeze, a big mouth ringed with red lipstick, chipmunk cheeks, and little eyes. Kind eyes. In fact, she's nice in general, Maria. Maria is a good cook, much better than my mom. Maria knows how to make borscht and other complicated soups. The apartment always smells like food. In the newspaper article, Maria was described as the only living relative willing to look after the three children left behind. "We weren't left behind," I grumbled, "and Maria didn't sacrifice some priceless existence for us." When you work in a cafeteria in Novosibirsk and you're asked if you'd like to go to Germany to make soup for a few kids, you've hit the lottery. Particularly since Maria had only briefly been married, once when she was young, maybe twice. She had no kids, no pets. As far as she was concerned, there was nothing to tire her, the studio apartment and the cafeteria. That's turned out not to be true. I could have told her so. Back in Novosibirsk, she could blather to everyone, and she did. But here, she's pretty much damned to silence. After almost 2 years here, Maria's German is limited to about 20 words, things like bus, potato, butter, trash, boil, wash, and fuck you, for the dark-haired teenagers who sometimes whistle and make vulgar gestures at her as she walks past. Occasionally, she tries to group her vocabulary into sentences. That usually doesn't work too well. When she's shopping anywhere but the Russian grocery, she has to point to whatever she wants and then write out the number she needs. She always carries a little notebook with her for exactly that purpose. Every time she comes back from the discount market, she's bathed in sweat. When she's spoken to on the street, she whimpers and gets red blotches on her face. I tried for 2 weeks to help her master the sentence, "I only speak Russian." She carries it around on a slip of paper in her wallet, transcribed phonetically in Cyrillic letters. Every day, she reads the latest sheet of her page-a-day calendar, one for the Russian Orthodox housewives, with a recipe on it, maybe a diet tip, and once in a while a joke, and that suffices. It makes me roll my eyes, but I make sure she doesn't see. After all, she can't help the fact that she's got too few synapses and that she lost 2/3 of them while she was working in the cafeteria. I just worry a little about Alyssa. At the moment, Maria has a slight intellectual edge over my not-quite-4-year-old sister. But that won't be the case for long. I've made reading books aloud a mandatory part of Maria's schedule. After the first time she read a picture book to Alyssa, she said, amazed, "I never knew such interesting books were written." I think you've heard enough to see that this character, has a remarkable voice and a fascinating one. Thank you very much. You can talk further out in the lobby and buy some books. I hope you will. And thank you so much, Alina, for being with us tonight. And
thanks to you very much. Thank you.
You've been listening to author Alina Bronski read from her novel Broken Glass at the Goethe Institute in Washington, D.C.